I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Yeah, hi everybody, and welcome to Talking Biotech number 34, if you're counting. I know I am. But 34 episodes, and today's is about time we got the strawberries. Now, strawberries is a crop, or are a crop, that I work with. I didn't always. And when I first took the job or interviewed at University of Florida, they asked me, well, would you be interested in working with strawberries? It's a really interesting opportunity in genomics, and no one has been there yet. And I said, great, love it, no can do it, I can get all over that. I'll just need some strawberry trees. And it just goes to show you how you can go, you can change gears in life. I had no clue, very little information on strawberries or agriculture, even 14, 15 years ago. But you change gears and you learn and you grow and you take on new opportunities. And so we did. And I think we went from maybe clueless in 2004 to a sequenced genome in 2010, and lots of other good resources in that time. So that was, but enough about me. Let's talk about Jim Hancock. And Jim Hancock comes to us from Michigan State University. He's one of the personalities in strawberries and in plant genomics. He's a plant breeder who works strawberry, blueberry, and other crops, who just has been one of my favorite people to get to know in biology, in our business. Just a pleasure and an endless resource. And he'll talk to us today about the domestication, the history, and some of the current breeding challenges with strawberry. And another Michigan State connection in part two. Michigan State connection is Michelle Payne Canoper. Michelle will talk to us in a new part I hope to really build called My Favorite Things. So a few of my favorite things. And I really wanted to talk to leaders in science and science communication about where do they get their information from. And Michelle is a professional speaker who regularly not only informs but entertains audiences with her excellent presentations in agriculture and the science that's behind agriculture. And just such a pleasure to talk to her today, and you'll get to hear that as well. So, without wasting a whole lot of time, we'll go right to Dr. Hancock and the amazing story of strawberries, which one of our more recent crops in terms of its evolution, and also one of the most genetically complex, yet genomically simple. And he'll talk about that. On to this week's interviews. Today on Talking Biotech, we go to East Lansing, Michigan, home of Michigan State University, and longtime home of our guest today, Professor Jim Hancock. Welcome to the podcast, Jim.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's Jim Hancock has very rich history in strawberry breeding and in blueberry breeding at Michigan State University, and has contributed very much to the activities in the horticultural sciences department, but also to the wider discipline. And I remember when I was just getting my feet wet in strawberries back in, not my feet wet like in strawberries, but learning the ropes in strawberries, that I read a lot of your work and found it very helpful and approachable, and was always so nervous about meeting you because I thought, you know, here's this this person who must be a crusty old guy who is not going to want to, who isn't going to be approachable. And it turns out you were one of my favorite people in the discipline after a while, and so glad to have you on today.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with the history of strawberry. strawberries have a really interesting reticulate history. And so what do we know, Jim, in terms of where we start from evolutionary origins and where this thing really came from?
Okay, well, you know, the strawberry, the dessert strawberry that we mostly eat, it's based on two species, Fragaria virginiana and Fragaria chiloensis. They're wild all through North America. At least Fragaria virginiana is found all through North America and Canada. Fragaria chiloensis is found sort of on the coast, the Pacific coast, from Alaska to the center of California and also Chile. That's an interesting story in itself we might want to get into. So those are the two progenitors of the strawberry.
So it's actually the one that we eat comes from two individuals that grow wild in different places, though. And can you tell us about the Chilean strawberry? What do we know about its origins and maybe its domestication?
Sure. Well, the actual Fragaria chiloensis in Chile was domesticated by the local Indians there, the Mapuches, probably 1 to 2,000 years ago. So long before Europeans got there, they actually were cultivating a strawberry. They actually were focused on white strawberries, but they also bred red ones as well. The story goes that when the Spanish started to try to colonize, that they would plant strawberries in open patches in the forest, and the Spaniards would take their helmets off, and then they could attack them when they wanted to eat the fruit. But it's so the Fragaria chiloensis has a long history of domestication. Fragaria virginiana never really was domesticated by itself.
And that's the one that we find growing in forests throughout North America.
That's right, all through North America.
So here you have stories of two different parents of the modern dessert strawberry. You've got some that are coming from South America, which have been at least somewhat improved from indigenous peoples, and another set that are up here in North America. And so how did these two get together to create what we know as strawberry?
It's a totally amazing story. The Fragaria virginiana found its way to Europe in the 1700s, probably collected by explorers on the eastern seaboard. And so it was there in botanical gardens, more or less, as a novelty. And there was a French spy sent to Chile to look at Spanish fortifications there. And he stumbled on the strawberries that the Mapuches had domesticated, thought they were unusually large compared to what was in Europe at the time, and took them back to France. They wound up in a French botanical garden. It turned out that they didn't produce fruit at all because he had collected females, and the two sexes are separate in Chile. So he didn't have anything to pollinate it. It couldn't make a fruit. And it happened to finally produce fruit when it was accidentally planted next to a Fragaria virginiana from the eastern seaboard of North America. And they accidentally hybridized, and that's the beginning of our dessert strawberry.
So
it's amazing.
It is such a cool story. So colonists in the 1500s and a spy from 17 something moving plants around, doing what nature didn't do, and putting both of these together they end up together in a French botanical garden. And the other really interesting layer of the story is the person who made the discovery. And what do we know about the person who really kind of facilitated that discovery and maybe even that pairing of virginiana and chiloensis?
Well, there was a French botanist, you know, and I've never been sure how to say his name. I've never heard anything. It's Duquesne or Duquesne. Maybe your French is better than mine.
I always said Duchesne, but
okay, well, maybe that's it then. But he was the one who actually figured out there were separate sexes, and he called the hybrid the pineapple strawberry because of a unique aroma that it had. But he was a pretty famous botanist that figured out that there had to have been a hybridization,
and hence the name Fragaria ananassa, which ananas is the Spanish for ananas is for pineapple.
I'd be hard-pressed to pick up a whole lot of smell of pineapple in today's strawberry, but it must have been stronger in those early ones.
Well, there's a few diploids that have that ester, and well, we can get to that maybe in a little bit.
Yeah, that's your expertise.
That I was under the impression that he was visiting the botanical gardens, started out going to the botanical gardens as a child and into his teens.
Yes. He had a long history there,
But his expertise as a botanist was actually gained at the knee of a botanist at the French Botanical Gardens, where he was able in Versailles, where he was able to learn about the different plants and actually took a liking to the strawberries in his teens, at least from the work from George Darrow.
Right.
Gave us some good hints on that. And there's since the time of that this hybridization occurred in the mid-1700s, what has happened in terms of strawberry improvement and strawberry breeding?
Well, you know, the nothing was done formally for probably a century. People kept finding these interesting hybrids, picking them out and cultivating them. But interestingly enough, the first breeder of strawberries was an Englishman, Thomas Knight, and about in the 1850s. And turns out he was actually the first formal breeder of any crop. The strawberry is the first crop that was actually formally bred, where somebody was making knowledgeable controlled crosses and picking out hybrids. So about the middle of the 18th century is when he did that work. He developed the first named varieties, if you will.
That's really interesting, because a lot of other interesting science came out of strawberries, as I understand from Darrow's work, that even Duchenne was doing crosses and looking, was able to generate what he called a genealogy, where he was able to arrange the specimens in the garden based on their complexity, based on fruit characteristics, and actually made a list that stands up to what we know today about ploidy, that he was able to estimate. I mean, he didn't know it, that he was estimating chromosome numbers, but it seemed to fit very well in his observations.
Right. You know, the strawberry has 8 sets of chromosomes. It's called an octoploid, which makes it pretty unusual among all the crop species. And there's been an interesting evolutionary history that's been worked out about what its progenitors must be. It turns out that there are actually 4 ploidy levels or 4 chromosome numbers in strawberries: diploids, which have 2, tetraploids, which have 4, hexaploids, which have 6, and then the octoploids that we consume the most have 8. And there's been a lot of recent evolutionary work trying to figure out which of those diploids were actually the ancestors of our cultivated octoploid. It's an interesting story in itself as well, because it turns out that one of those progenitors is Fragaria vesca, which is found all across Europe and Asia and North America. But the other progenitor is most likely a thing called Fragaria anume, which is only found in Japan. So the original progenitor of our strawberry must have arisen somewhere in Asia. Unfortunately, there aren't any octoploids now in Asia, except for one specimen or two of a thing called Fragaria and iteropensis that people have studied. So we've got the octoploids that are growing all over North America and found their way to Chile, but we have no progenitor in Asia where it must have happened.
Yeah, so maybe the question is if the polyploidization events actually occurred in the New World.
Maybe. But yeah. One of those species is, of course, now extinct in the New World, if it was there.
Ah, that's right. Well, it is an interesting question, because, and maybe just to kind of clarify for those who are listening, that when we're talking about ploidy, we're talking about chromosome complements. And when we're talking about, so humans are diploid. We have a set of chromosomes from mom, a set of chromosomes from dad. And as we've discussed on this podcast, things like bananas that are seedless are triploid. They have 2 from one parent, 1 from another. We also know that plants can have these events where you do transmit an abnormal number of chromosomes to your offspring. And if one that makes too many and another one that makes too many get together, that's one mechanism, that we can develop these polyploids. And one of the interesting things about polyploids in plants, say that 10 times fast, is that they tend to develop larger organs and larger fruit. So this is why maybe polyploidization events have been favored, at least in making these plants more attractive to people that may be eating them. So.
Right. Evolutionarily, you know, there's a lot of ideas about why polyploids formed in the first place. But, you know, it's what it's mostly been discovered is you can go up in chromosome number, but you can't come back down. So if you have enough random events, you're eventually going to go up in ploidy number over time.
Yeah, that's right. And it seems like you actually lose some material as you increase your ploidy. So as you gain more and more chromosomes, there's pieces of material or whole segments that seem to disappear or maybe are changed in other ways. That, in other words, the octoploid strawberry, we know its genome size is not equal to four times a diploid.
Exactly. I mean, you have essentially many copies of every gene, and so you can lose a gene or two in evolutionary time and not really hurt the function of the plant.
So I'll ask you some questions from your experience as a breeder, and I think this is really interesting to for a listener who we hear all this discussion about narrow genetics and monocultures and things like that. Strawberry, if the story is correct, really goes back to one plant from a French botanical garden. How much variation is there now, and where did that come from? And is strawberry really a narrow genetic base?
Well, it is a very narrow genetic base. It obviously no longer traces back to a single individual. And people figured out pretty quickly that they were hybrids once they started to formally breed. So they did begin to bring in a number of Virginia analines from the U.S. and the breeding programs in Britain and France. They started to bring in some Chiloensis. But still, if you really examine the number of parents that are in the background of our commercial strawberries, as far as wild clones are concerned, it's really only a handful. It may be 25 or 30 is all. So it's very narrow, much narrow if you consider the vast region that the two progenitor species are. So there's lots of genetics that we haven't touched on or accessed yet.
And does that really make you excited about, as a breeder, thinking about how, you know, now we have some genomics tools at our disposal, things like that? I know for me as a I don't want to say a closet breeder, but a breeding admirer, as somebody who really admires plant breeders and what they do and gets excited about new varieties, I think I would love to go back to all the diploids and make synthetic octoploids, make new weird combinations just to see what we could get in terms of disease resistance traits and maybe some better flavors. And does that seem realistic at all?
Yeah, sure, it's realistic. And in fact, I've lost his name, but a scientist at Guelph actually did a number of those. But, you know, it almost makes more sense to work at the octoploid level because they're going to be directly compatible with what we're breeding with. And I've actually been involved in a project where what we call it is reconstructing the strawberry. And what we've done is we and other colleagues, Chad Finn, Adam Dale, Jim Luby, we've gone out into the natural populations all over North America and in Chile, identified what looked to be the most useful horticulturally valuable clones in the wild, and then we set about rehybridizing both Virginiana and Chiloensis. So we've reconstructed. And the best of all of the selections that we've made actually has two subspecies of Virginiana and two subspecies of Chiloensis in its background. And it almost has commercial-sized fruit. It's truly remarkable. And The clones, the original parents, came from Ontario, Wyoming, Chile, and California. So we think we have a really useful tool for people to access more variability in the future.
Right. So just to explain for the listener, that kind of background, now that you've made this really strong mix of genes from different places, different variants, different alleles that may bring different disease resistance to the table or different flavors or plant qualities. Now this resource exists where you could breed this against maybe varieties that do well commercially and incorporate some of these traits that maybe breeders have lost.
Exactly. And it's right there. And you know, the nice thing about it is this is a population of about 120 different individuals. So each of them has some subset of those genes. And we can make this population available to any breeder who is interested in accessing new genetic variability. And they can screen the population for whatever it is they're interested in and then incorporate their specific needs into their breeding program.
Now, what are some of the traits that modern breeders are looking for? What's important?
Well, obviously, flavor remains there. And, you know, we, during the early course of breeding, we did lose an awful lot of the flavor and the aromas that you were talking about earlier that we certainly want to go back and access. But there's a lot of disease resistances that would be particularly valuable. One of the big problems right now is we relied in strawberry production on methyl bromide fumigation of the soil to kill soil pathogens. We no longer have that tool, and so we need to access new genetic variability to find those resistances. So those are a couple of the ideas.
What are some of the challenges that our farmers face to create a profitable crop of strawberry?
Yeah, okay. Well, part of it's luck, obviously. I mean, when you want to harvest fruit to sell it, you need some reasonable atmospheric conditions. If it rains the whole time during the harvest, you're sunk. There's that kind of thing. But there's lots of lingering problems in the Midwestern part of the United States. Cold hardiness, you know, winter hardiness, whether they can survive the winter is a major problem. Spring frosts, which eliminate or annihilate the flower buds is a major problem. And again, I go back to the soil pathogens as being a major problem for most of our growers, along with a lot of fruit rots. So there's a good bit of problems that face the grower.
Yeah, it's one of the things we've noticed down here in Florida since the loss of methyl bromide, the soil fumigant. We've seen an emergence of new diseases and nematode pressures, but new diseases that
exactly
have never shown up before in strawberry.
Exactly. And that, again, that's why I think, you know, a big future as far as the strawberry industry is concerned is to access genetics from these wild populations to go after some of these emerging problems, because breeders just haven't been selecting for those resistances in the past, and we may have actually lost any resistance genes we might have had because we've never been selecting for it.
And I think that's really an important point. I think that strawberry could be a kind of a trendsetter in a lot of ways, because there's so much untapped biological diversity in wild populations that do just well with it, perfectly fine growing in sand on the side of a cliff in Oregon, that they don't care about fertilizer. They make fruits. They're happy as can be. And if we could get these genetics incorporated into commercial varieties, it may be of great benefit. And also that, you know, we neglected to mention, strawberry is a little bit of a pioneer for a much larger family of important hort crops. So what else is related to strawberry?
Well, it's rosaceous, which means we're talking about raspberries, we're talking about roses, and we're talking about a number of the tree fruits, cherries, peach. So there, a lot of the information that we can generate in strawberries can be used in other crops as well.
That's pretty exciting because strawberries, the I think, you know, if, unless you look at some of the obscure ones, it's kind of the only one you can grow a bunch of them in a greenhouse and get them from seed to flower in a season and in a couple of months sometimes if you force them. And that gives us a really important tool that maybe we could use strawberry, and always been my argument, that we could use strawberry as a gene discovery tool to be able to inform breeding activities in the larger tree crops and things like roses and brambles. And what kind of efforts are in that area? Are there any translational efforts that you're aware of, or is there any biotechnology happening in strawberry?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a couple things going on. You interviewed Amy Iazzoni recently. I don't think you talked about the rose breed project that she's spearheaded, but there's a federally funded huge project, $10 million, $15 million, that's bringing together breeders and biotechnologists in all of these different rosaceous crops together. And a big goal of this is gene discovery in the individual crops and trying to translate that information to the other ones. So there's a big, big effort to do just what you're talking about. And part of the whole goal of this is once you've identified these critical genes, to find DNA diagnostic markers that are nearby them in the chromosome so that in breeding you can actually specifically breed for those traits without having to actually look at the plant or taste the plant. You can actually anticipate what it will have. So that's the big ongoing effort. But there are also people now that are sequencing the whole strawberry genome, the octoploid genome, and ultimately we're going to be able to identify specific genes and target those specific genes in our breeding programs.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up rose breed. I know we had Amy on a few weeks ago, and we really focused on cherries and sweet cherries, tart cherries, and didn't get much into the, or didn't touch on at all on the rose breed issue. I'm hoping that maybe just devote an entire session to that later on. But at least in the short term, it's a really nice opportunity to, as you mentioned, develop diagnostic tools that can relate across species, and or at least within populations of one species and one pedigree, and then maybe translate across species. And those would be tremendously powerful tools that could help inform these efforts going forward.
Right. And you know, some of the crops are way ahead of the other crops. Peach and apple, particularly apple, had far in advance of the other crops in the genomic tools that have been developed. And it's been really wonderful to work with those folks on some of our other crops like strawberries and rose that are lagging behind, because we essentially get a jump start by sharing information.
So what's the future of strawberry and strawberry breeding? What are we going to see happening in the next few years, and what really is the new focus, or what do you, in your opinion, what do you see happening?
Well, you know, one thing that's happened in strawberries, interestingly enough, is the industry keeps growing and growing and growing and growing, and it's a percent or two every couple of years. So worldwide, people love their strawberries in it, and it keeps tremendously growing. I think that flavor and health are going to become a bigger impact in the future. A lot of the things like yield and resistances to fruit rots, we've got a good handle on that, but we haven't really focused on flavor. So I think flavor and the nutrition are going to be big points. I think that this whole idea of developing strawberries that are resistant to soil pathogens is going to be huge. It's been essentially ignored in the past because it could rely on, you know, the ozone depleting methyl bromide. But now that we've lost that, we're going to have to focus it. So I think that's going to be a big area in the future.
Yeah, we didn't talk about transgenic effort, you know, or genetic engineering efforts, but you know, my lab, we've come up with strawberries expressing cystatins, which showed some positive effects and resistance to nematodes. Never even published that work, the postdoc, she decided she wasn't coming to work one year. And I can't find
love the, that.
Yeah. And I can't find the any of the data, but we did have some nice transgenics there that did some good work. And also the we've made the NPR1 overexpressors, which don't get disease, but they also don't make very many flowers or runners. So you solve one problem, you create another. And, you know, hopefully in the future we'd be able to maybe tweak that a touch. But those kind of solutions may be in the pipeline as well, depending upon how, you know, social change and acceptability towards those solutions.
You know, that's the big issue with Strawberry. There's two issues as far as, you know, the GE approaches. One is there's still this worry that the consumers are going to be nervous about eating a strawberry where it was genetically modified. So the industry is still queasy about that. We know that whatever would be released would be totally safe, but people are worried about the process and worried about the unexpected, if you will. But the other particular problem with strawberries is we have these wild populations all over the place. And it would be only a matter of time till there would be a genetic hybrid formed between a GE strawberry and a wild one. So we have to be particularly careful that however we engineer the strawberry, it's not going to have any impact on the natural environment. There are a series of straightforward experiments that can be done to document whether they're safe or not, but it's costly. And strawberries are a minor enough crop that no one has wanted to face that regulatory hurdle yet.
Yeah, I know nobody has been banging down my door saying we, you know, want those solutions. They all say, oh, that would be great, because if we could grow plants without using any fungicides, that would be super. But, you know, the threat of having activists say, don't buy strawberries from, you know, so-and-so, or don't buy them from this company, or, you know, the getting the consumer backlash. And then also the caveats you mentioned that, you know, there's wild strawberries pretty much all over North America, except for Florida, at least that we've ever found. And you do have those concerns about containment. And it's a bigger issue with strawberries than probably any other crop that I can think of.
Yeah, I think virtually all the genetically modified crops that we grow in the U.S. don't have wild progenitors here. So that whole possibility of hybridizing with the wild just doesn't exist. You know, it's a regulatory issue. I mean, it's a cost issue. It's not an overall safety issue as far as the technology is concerned.
And how much of the public consternation came from the stories of fish genes in strawberries?
Oh yeah, it didn't help. But you know, I mean, I wouldn't be worried about eating a fish gene in strawberry if it had gone through our U.S. regulatory process. It's a good one.
Well, and if you have if you sat down with a fish genome and a strawberry genome, you would find a relatively strong set of alignments that were pretty convincing. I mean, the genes aren't that different for many of the central functions of a eukaryotic cell, of a nucleated cell. So, you know, both of us share a common ancestor somewhere, and there's plenty of reminders of that throughout the genome. So I really enjoyed the conversation. It really was nice to talk to an expert about this crop that I really care about that contributes a lot to my state's economy. Thank you so much for joining me, Jim. Professor Jim Hancock from Michigan State University Department of Horticulture, thank you for joining me on Talking Biotech.
I enjoyed it very much, and as you know, I have the highest respect for you and was pleased to have this opportunity.
Thank you so much, Jim. We'll see you pretty soon.
Okay, great.
Hello, everybody. Now, you might have noticed that the Talking Biotech podcast frequently incorporates guest hosts. The goal here is to expose those interested in science communication to a wider audience and maybe provide a friendly entrance to how to actually engage the public in a meaningful way. Now, it's always hard to take that first step, but I'm glad to offer this platform for you to tell your story and work with me in discussing new technologies with people that created them or understand them well. So if you're interested in joining me as a co-host, send a note to talkingbiotechpodcast@gmail.com and let me know. We'll devise questions together. We'll find fun ways to make you part of the discussion. Heck, you do the whole damn thing. I'll just listen. Remember, science flows best when innovation moves to application, and that takes communication. If this vehicle can bring more voices to the discussion, it only amplifies my interest in sharing the beautiful stories of science and technology that can help people and help the planet. Okay, so on this section of Talking Biotech, we're going to try something new. A lot of people ask me, where do I find very helpful news or articles on social media? And instead of sharing what I find very helpful, I'd like to talk about what others who are currently very active in agriculture and agricultural communications, what they find very helpful. And today I'm really pleased to have with us Michelle Payne Noper, who wrote the book No More Food Fights. She's a professional speaker and author who is constantly busy on the road talking about why agriculture needs to have a better voice in the discussion. And thank you very much for joining us, Michelle.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate you having me.
So what else are you up to these days in terms of future work?
Well, I am very excited because I actually am getting ready to turn in my manuscript for a book called Food Truths: From Farm to Table, 25 Surprising Ways to Shop and Eat Without Guilt. And the book addresses myths around the grocery store with truths from both the farm plate and science through stories. So I will be glad when that's turned in. And hopefully, if everything goes well with the publisher, you will see it on bookshelves in Thanksgiving time.
And what kind of other work do you do from day to day? I know that I met you in Saskatoon talking to kind of an agriculture technology group. And what other types of audiences do you speak to, and what is your usual role?
Well, I really try to work to translate the science and practices of farming today to people both within agriculture and outside of agriculture. So groups that I work with include agriculture organizations, from farm bureaus to universities to agribusinesses to dietetic groups to different food groups. So I do actually work full-time as a speaker. I get paid to talk, believe it or not, and really feel honored to be able to do that because I am a farm girl through and through. One of my degrees is in science. I worked in a reproductive physiology laboratory during both of my undergrad degrees and believe fully in science. But unfortunately, I think in today's society, we have a world that doesn't understand science, and so that we need to do a better job of communicating about that, particularly in agriculture. So I really try to train people to do that as well as motivate them.
And you're also you're the real deal. I mean, you're the person who actually does have a lot of experience on the farm too, right?
Well, I fed my baby calf this morning. I'm careful not to call myself a farmer out of respect for people who farm full time. But yes, I still have a dairy cattle out in my front yard, most of which are descendants from a cow that I bought for $7,000 when I was 12 years old. So agriculture is near and dear to my heart. I love to eat chocolate, wine, Cheetos, you name it. Now, I actually do try to be healthy, but I see that there's some real opportunities for us to connect across the food plate, and happen to believe that the stories of agriculture and of farmers and ranchers and agriculture folks are really critical in doing that. And likewise, that we need to be able to reach across from the agriculture side and understand what chefs and dietitians and moms and grocery store buyers are asking and why they're asking, rather than taking it so personally.
Wow. And I love this mission because that it sounds so much with like what I want to learn to do better. Being able to, you know, I can talk to science nerds all day and that's fine. But it's so cool to be able to talk to dietitians and to public audiences and have to reformulate your message and rethink, well, what's important to them and what do they need to walk out of here with? And it's like a really interesting thing because you talk to an audience like that, you don't really get a second shot that day if you don't hit the nail on the head. So it's lots of thinking ahead. But what are some of your biggest challenges in different audiences?
Probably my biggest challenge is biting my tongue. you know, for example, I've mentioned that I'm a dairy girl and I have registered Holsteins, and it saddens me a great deal when I hear how people talk about dairy farmers abusing the animals. And I really especially in writing the second book, because it is strictly a consumer-facing book. When I stepped back and wrote the 25 food truths to help people shop and eat without guilt, I really had to try to take off my farmer hat. And I had to think about all of the questions that I've been asked. You know, why do people think that hormones are bad? Well, because they probably don't understand the science behind them. Why do people think that antibiotics are only negative and don't have positives? Again, because they don't understand the science behind it. So one of the greatest challenges is biting my tongue and not taking it personally. And I think that all of us, whether you're a scientist or whether you're a farmer, have a really hard time separating ourselves from our work because it is so personal, right? I mean, you take your work very personally, Kevin.
Oh, sure.
So biting the tongue and then also trying to be armed with the adequate amount of facts so that I can represent the agriculture business well. Because of the fact that I don't specialize in just one area, I work across the entire agri-food business, and I do try to work with dietitians. What I have found is that really working with my community as a resource makes me a whole lot smarter and be a whole lot more effective. So I certainly will share my own farm story, which includes some rather terrible things that have happened, as well as wonderful positive stories that we all have from the farm. And then I also share other stories because I think that is a very effective way to showcase people, this is where your beef comes from. This is what a beef producer looks like. This is why they do what they do. And this is what somebody who's using biotechnology looks like. This is what transgenics looks like on a farm. And this is important to farmers. And here's why. So it's really about the opportunity to convey that story. And then, as you've experienced yourself, understanding that not everybody's going to like the story and be okay with that.
Well, that's a good point. And but at the same time, one of the other things I've learned in terms of tongue biting, which I've had to do a fair amount of, is that I do a lot less of it if I do more ear opening. And that if I start out any conversation by saying, you know, why are you concerned, and what specifically bothers you, and really starting to understand their concerns rather than getting upset or dismissing them or wanting to say something snarky out of hand. I listen to what they say very carefully and intently. Then I get snarky. No, I think it's the idea is just that I try not to be. I love that. I'm good at that, but I've had to really dial that down. I like to be able to just understand what bothers somebody, because before I can try to communicate with them, I need to understand what kind of critter they are and yes. where they're getting their information and how they weight different brands of information. And then now they've just told me all the keys to the castle, because now I can come back and say, okay, well, let me tell you what I know from this, this, and this.
Yeah, it's amazing how if you can connect with somebody on a personal level, how you can relate to them more effectively. I always call this hot buttons. It's about what really excites people. And, you know, a silly example that I use with a lot of my audiences is that I happen to be a huge Michigan State fan. I happen to believe that we're the best land grant out there, have the best basketball program in the country, and that Tom Izzo pretty much walks on water. And not a lot of people necessarily agree with that, but that's a way of connecting with people's hot buttons on a personal level. You know, on a sports level, on a university level.
That's right.
And then I can in turn be more human to them. Whereas if I just approach them as an agriculturalist and said, you need to understand X, Y, Z, people aren't interested in that. So one of the things that is really critical when I work with scientists specifically is that science isn't sexy. Science doesn't sell. And I mean no disrespect to anybody out there who works in the science world. But the reality is that as a scientist, you have to connect with people on a personal level before they are interested in you, quote, educating them. Because in today's social world, people aren't interested in education. They're on information overload. They're interested more in having conversations and in full transparency and all that sort of good stuff.
No, you nailed it. And I learned that the hard way. I've been trying to talk to people about science for 15 years. And really only in the last 3 or 4 did I start to figure out what you just told me, that it's not about saturating people with all the information I can pump out of my, you know, 30-year background in science. It's really about how do I understand what their concerns are, what their interests are, and what they want to know, and then how do I shape a story to help lead them to that reality. as well as be transparent about why I feel the way I do and where they can get more information, both for and against my opinion.
Yeah.
And if you put all that on the table and you make yourself available, it does help guide somebody. And I think that it's that kind of honesty which has really allowed me to change a lot of hearts and minds and maybe put a big target on my back at the same time.
Perhaps. But when you make those human connections, people don't forget you because, you know, there is an old quote out there that I think a lot of folks recognize from Maya Angelou. People will forget what you say. People will forget what you do, but they will never forget the way you make them feel. And when you can connect with somebody through their hot buttons and have a true conversation, they feel very different than if you're trying to stuff information down their throat. And sometimes it can be very simple. To give you a quick example, in my research for my new book, I sat down with several groups of other mothers and so forth, and they, by the end of the conversation, said, "Michelle, we just want to know what you buy at the grocery store." And that was a huge win for me because the conversation started off with, why do chicken farmers cram chickens in cages? And when I shared with them that A, broilers aren't actually raised in cages, and B, by the way, did you know that chickens are not only scavengers, they're also omnivores, and if given the opportunity, they will peck and eat each other. People start opening their minds when you present it to them in a way that is digestible to them. And I very much believe that the only way to be able to relate science to most people, not everyone, but particularly to the mom crowd, the only way to relate science is to make it matter to them on a personal level. So,
no, that's excellent advice. And it's something you do really well. I really appreciated your talk when I saw it. And it was one of those things where I was going after you and I thought, okay, well, now what do I do? You know, she just said everything I'd like to say, only 10 times better.
I don't know about that. You know, I will say, Kevin, I think one of the most powerful things that you would agree with is that within our agricultural community, and particularly because of social media, that we have a lot of connections that maybe we didn't used to have, and that we have the opportunity to learn from each other and to have people to turn to. It's impossible for me to understand all the intricacies of GMO and everything that's happening in gene editing, but I know people like you that I can turn to in a heartbeat if I need to have that answered or to research it further. And I think that makes all of us stronger, is to realize we don't have to have all the answers, but we know people who do.
That's right. Just like any good network, you have your chain of experts who can be interdependent. And I think we are really, and it took us a long time to develop that and understand that as a discipline. And I think now we're really starting to gel a little bit across the board. And certainly as these issues have become more of interest to especially agricultural groups, and then also to scientists. As scientists want to learn more about communicating in agriculture space and in just communicating science, that a lot of the connections are becoming more frequent. I see different people more and more on a more cyclical basis, which I think is really good.
Yes, I would absolutely agree. And, you know, one of the things that I'd point out to your listeners, that if you're interested in connecting with other folks in agriculture, to check out some different things like AgChat on Twitter, which is hashtag AGCHAT, or hashtag FoodChat. We could always use more scientific perspective, and that's a conversation that happens every week from 8 to 10 Eastern time. Ag Chat happens 3 weeks of the month, and then Food Chat happens once, and the Ag Chat Foundation manages that. But communities like that really foster the networking that you're talking about, and I think also helps us all be a little bit stronger in knowing the facts. Because, for example, I don't know anything about strawberry breeding, and I've had a million friends tell me that watermelons are biotech and GMO, seedless watermelons, to be clear. And because of you, I know that they're not. And so it's even those little types of facts that I think help us all communicate more effectively.
So step back, if you don't mind. What were the two hashtags that you just mentioned?
Hashtag AgChat, AGCHAT, and hashtag FoodChat, FoodChat.
And those
both of those are managed by the AgChat Foundation.
And those were 8 p.m. Eastern time or 8 a.m.?
8 p.m. Thank you for the clarification. farmers are out taking care of their land and animals at 8 a.m.
I know.
It's 8 p.m.
But there's going to be somebody in Hawaii who writes me a flaming email and calls me a Monsanto time shill, burying the actual information. You know, it'll happen.
Yeah, well, I've been called a lot worse than a shell myself, so I get it. Trust me.
So that is a really good segue into what I had planned for today, and that what I wanted to do was bring in over the next several weeks or however long this lasts, people who I really like their ideas and really appreciate their offerings in terms of media and social media, and ask them where they get theirs. And what I would love to know from you is, what are maybe the top places where you go to broaden what you do, or maybe reinforce what you know, or maybe learn a little bit more about agriculture, science, and the ways to communicate it?
Sure. Well, I'm probably a little bit odd because I have my finger in so many different parts of agriculture. So I look very big picture, sometimes to the point where I'm not sure that it makes sense to anyone else in the world. One of my favorite sources, and probably my top source for information in my first book and my second book, is Food Insight, which is the International Food Information Council. You can find them at Food Insight on various social handles, or IFIC.org, or I think foodinsight.com. I'm not sure about that one. A great unbiased resource in a wide variety of subjects. For example, I was just writing about some of the things that happen around WHO and the claims around cancer and meat, and the fact that cancer and the sun meat and the sun have about the same correlation as causing cancer. They had some really great information on that. Likewise, they had information on sugars when I was writing about the facade of how bad sugars are for you and those sorts of things. So they're my top resource that I go to on a bevy of food issues. They have a section for journalists as well as scientists and consumers, I believe, but really a great resource. Another one would be genetic literacy, heavy science, for those of you that are out there that love biotech and everything genetics. I really like the Genetic Literacy Project. They have a great deal of explanation about what's happening in genetics today, not only in agriculture but elsewhere. And one of the things that I like to do is to try to get people who are buying food to think about the correlation between animal and plant genetics and human genetics, and what's happening as far as some of the benefits that have happened in medicine and benefits that have happened in reproduction, as an example, happen in animals first, and that there are some very clear correlations there. Okay. So those are a couple of big picture ones.
Well, both of those are two really good ones. And I'll make sure I put all of the links on the website. And I should go back and also state, someone said that I don't say who I'm talking to enough, so people will, I don't know, wake up from a nap or, you know, coma or something and be curious who I'm talking to. Michelle Payne-Noper, who is a public speaker, agriculture communicator, and other things, she's sharing with us her favorite blogs and websites for good information in agriculture and science. So what else do you have, Michelle?
Well, to whoever woke up from a coma, welcome back.
I would really well imagine waking up to my nasally drone.
I don't want to insult you, but I was going to point out the fact that if somebody's waking up from a coma, I don't think they'd be listening to a podcast of us. But
okay. So what else do you like on especially in social media space that maybe you get some good information?
Sure. Well, I play a great deal in Twitter, and so my world in Twitter is probably ruled by hashtags and learning different hashtags to monitor and check out. And because of the fact that I work with dietitians, I look at what some of them are doing and so forth. So it's just a matter of trying to find what works for you. And I would say the same is true in Instagram. I'm very visual, so I love Instagram, and I would challenge any scientist out there. Matter of fact, you can tell me if I'm wrong. Feel free to email me at mpk@causematters.com. I would challenge any scientist to share visuals from your lab and talk about what you're doing. I've not seen it done in agriculture sciences. I've seen some from the barn in the field as far as scientific research, but I think it would be fascinating for scientists to be able to share visuals on what they're doing. That doesn't actually require you to talk unless you do video. You can just share a photo. And one of the critical things that you'll learn is that hashtags are really important. A couple of other sources that I like to go to outside of the actual social channels, I enjoy The Farmer's Life. He's become a personal friend, Brian Scott. He's actually here in Indiana, though I'm not sure we've ever seen each other in the state. We usually see each other outside of the state at Ag Chat events. But Brian does a great job at The Farmer's Life, and that is his handle across all social channels, and it's also his blog name. He does a great job of sharing what's happening in the field today as far as technology, whether it would be GMO, whether it would be drones. He actually shoots videos of him flying his drone over his neighbor while his neighbor's mowing his yard and Brian likes to buzz him. It's really funny. So I enjoy that because I think he offers a really practical perspective. Another farmer that I enjoy because she's a dietitian and because she has a tendency to be conveying things effectively for consumers is Jennifer Schmidt, and her blog is Foodie Farmer. She does some really interesting work as far as talking. Actually, her last one was on allergens and GMOs and the fact that they're not related. So I thought that was very intriguing. As far as nutrition information, I always go to the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. If you're not familiar, they are what used to be the American Dietetic Association, and I always go straight there, as well as the dietary guidelines, whenever I'm looking for nutrition information. And my counsel to folks is always to find a registered dietitian who should be making scientifically based recommendations. Per the Academy standards. That doesn't always happen these days, but they are supposed to be making scientifically based. And then a couple of other ones. Marie Bowers out in Oregon, because Oregon has faced their own issues out there, does a really nice job at Oregon Green, and the URL is OregonGreenBlog.com. She's also on Twitter and so forth. So those are probably a handful of a few. You know, I hesitate to name people by name because of the fact that there's so many, but I would invite you all to go onto my website, which is causematters.com. I keep a list of scientific blogs, so if you have a scientific blog that you would like to have added and it's related to food and agriculture or science communications or finding evidence-based science, I would be delighted to add you to the list, so please just email me. And then I have a much larger list of farmers and ranchers across the world that blog there, as well as a list of advocate blogs. And those last two are all sorted by regions, so you can sort out depending on what area of the country you're in and check them out.
Wow, this is like a pinata. I hit it just right. So what's really cool about this is that you do provide a very good glimpse and a cross-section of a lot of the same resources I like. A lot of the same people who I'm interested in what they do. You know, Brian, I actually drove through your town to get to Brian's town one time up in Indiana. So
stopping by to say hi.
I know I should have. I didn't realize at the time. those are really good hints as to where people could start to identify new sources of information to help them become better, as you say, advocates. And also more well-versed in the agricultural side of different technologies and even just the basics of how it's done. And I think that's really great. So.
It's really interesting for us to watch what's happening in different parts of the country and different parts of the world. We all have a tendency to get a little entrenched in our own world, and it's useful to gain perspective on what's happening. You know, for example, where I live in Indiana, water's not a big deal, but I've also lived in California, and I know personally how big of a deal it is out there. Likewise, if you look at what's happening in Oregon, and I mentioned that Marie, you know, a lot of things are happening in Oregon that, quite frankly, could be trend-setting for the rest of the country and are a bit scary. So that's why I put together that compilation of blogs on my website, is because of the fact that I think it's really useful for all of us to learn from each other.
Do you have any, where else can people find you other than, so causematters.com that you mentioned, but what about on Twitter or Instagram, other social media?
I am across almost every social media channel with the exception of Snapchat, and all of my handles are at M Payne Knoper, so it's M, P as in Paul, A-Y-N, K-N-O-P-E-R. And so you can look for me on Twitter, on Instagram. My Facebook page is my full name plus Cause Matters. And I'm also on LinkedIn and Pinterest and Plus and probably a couple of others that I don't even remember. So I love to connect with people. And if you're a scientist listening, first, thanks for what you do, because you probably don't get told that enough. But secondly, I'd love to connect with you. I think we have a fascinating story to tell, and I'd love to help as many people in the agri-food sciences tell that as possible.
Well, thank you very much. That's Michelle Payne Knoper, who's a professional speaker for agriculture and science, also author of the book No More Food Fights, and also the upcoming book. What's the name of the new one coming up again?
It is Food Truths from Farm to Table, 25 Surprising Ways to Shop and Eat Without Guilt.
Oh, I can't wait.
I bet you can.
But isn't it funny how every book that ever comes out is all of the dangers and all of the bad stuff and all of the... I started to think about this, and how would it be to live where you're afraid of the healthiest, safest food supply in the history of the planet, and to live in constant fear and suspicion that you're being systematically poisoned. It just would be such a grim existence. And so I really hope your book really helps people feel more comfortable with their eating, think about the good things that we have, to celebrate the wonderful things that agriculture gives us, and maybe that'll just turn this around for us.
Well, funny thing that you should say that, Kevin, because the last line in the book is actually enjoy food as a celebration, because we do live in a time where people fear their food. And it saddens me when I sit around with other moms and other folks that are out there buying food. It really saddens me that they believe that they need to fear what they're buying, and they feel bad because they don't think they're doing the right thing for their kids. And that's really unfortunate, because as you've already noted, we have an incredibly safe food supply, and we are doing things and using technology in a way that has never been done before. But I think what we have not done is talk about it. So as I have been finishing up probably what will be around 80,000 words for this book, I actually wrote the conclusion pretty early because the fact that was the most joyous part of the book to write, because I truly believe that we need to focus on food as sustenance. Food is an opportunity to celebrate with those that you love, and food should be appreciated, not feared. So please stop feeling guilty about it. So I'm right there on the same page with you. We definitely have to enjoy food as a celebration.
Thank you very much, Michelle. I really appreciate all you do. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Kevin.
And that's Michelle Payne Knoper, calling today from Indiana about her thoughts on social media and her favorite websites. What are a few of her favorite things when she's looking for information to further her education in this area? And Michelle's a favorite of mine. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you once again for your thoughts and comments. It's been a wonderful couple of weeks to read about what you think about everything in agriculture and food. So I'm Kevin Folta. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast. Thank you very much for listening. And we'll talk to you again next week.